From the fall of the Western Roman Empire to the Renaissance and the Age of Discovery, it's Renee Ward with another edition of the Medieval Podcast, from the University of Lincoln to the world.
Thanks, Alex, and it certainly does feel like a very long time since we have been not in this space, because we're not in the studio, but certainly online doing any kind of podcast for medieval studies. So it's wonderful that we can do this in some virtual format for this year. And I would like to introduce a new segment of the podcast, something that we're going to do over the next year and then hopefully continually, is to feature early career researchers and graduate students at the University of Lincoln that are pursuing topics or research in the medieval period. My guests for today are one of each, in fact. The first speaker or the first guest is Paula Del Val Vallès. And Paula is a first-year PhD candidate at the University of Lincoln. She holds a BA in history from the Universidad Complutense de Madrid, where she obtained the Premio de Excelencia Complutense, and an MA in medieval studies with distinction from King's College London, which she finished in 2020. She is also a member of the Spanish research group Murarquas, and a founding member of the Young Researchers Association, Asociación Jimena.
Hi, Renee.
No, go right ahead. That's great.
Hi. Thank you for having me today.
No, it's wonderful to have you here. And it's amazing that we are able to do these things despite the continued lockdown and conditions that we are living with. Our second speaker is an early career research fellow at the University of Lincoln, Anaïs Vague, and she is an early career fellow, a Leverhulme early career fellow in the School of History and Heritage at the university, who specializes in gender studies and women's history with a particular focus on power, rulership, and political communication, which she studies from a comparative perspective. As an undergraduate student, Anaïs studied history and political science at Fordham University in New York City, and then moved to London, where she completed her MA in medieval history at King's College. And then she went on to undertake her doctoral research at the same institution under the supervision of Dr. Alice Taylor and also John Sabapathy at UCL. She completed her PhD in 2020. So you actually have a shared educational background as well.
We do, yes.
Welcome to both of you. So I wanted to ask you some questions, and this is a little bit different style of podcast. Normally we have a thematic approach, and in some ways there is a thematic approach that, as we will discuss in the next little bit, is linked to your research. But as I said, this is also to focus on what is increasingly a growing population of medievalists at the University of Lincoln, and certainly at the graduate level or the early career research level. So I thought it might be useful for you both to start by outlining your current projects and discussing the women in particular that you are researching. So Paula, if you'd like to maybe start, and then Anaïs can speak about her project afterwards.
Sure. Well, at the moment, I'm a first year MPhil PhD candidate, and my thesis focuses on the study of the Queen's household. Well, at first, it's easy to think maybe women's or a queen's household is simply the queen's entourage, her ladies-in-waiting, and a chaplain. But the thing is that in the 13th century, these were actually much more than that. Queen's households could work as autonomous institutions, even economically independent from the king in some cases, and with their own resources, personnel, structure. But this is a matter that it's still unclear in some kingdoms, among those Castile and Aragon for the 13th century. So my thesis aims to provide a comparative study that tackles these questions through Castile, Aragon, and England. And in the terms of the women I'm working on, so it comprises 14 women. It's six Castilian queens, who are Leonor Plantagenet, Berenguela of Castile, Beatrice of Suabia, Jeanne of Ponthieu, Violante of Aragon and Maria of Molina. Then five Aragonese queens, who are Sancha of Castile, Maria of Montpellier, Leonor of Castile, Violante of Hungary, and Constance of Hohenstaufen. And finally, three more English 13th century queens, Isabel of Angoulême, Eleanor of Provence, and Eleanor of Castile. Although in the English case, I do have a particular focus in Eleanor of Provence that Anaïs also studies, as I'm sure she'll go on to say now.
That's a huge list.
Yeah.
It's a lot of women. And I might have a question to ask you about that later, because I think there's some really interesting things happening here. Anaïs?
So similarly to Paola, I also have a large list of women. My study is a comparative study of the 15 earliest claims by female heiresses to royal thrones in medieval Europe between 1109 and 1328. And 1109 is when we get kind of the first claim made, and 1328 is kind of when the so-called Salic Law was invoked in Capetian France to bar women from access to the French throne. And what my project does is kind of examine how first, on one hand, kind of examine first how these claims were handled in the moment, what allowed some heiresses to succeed where others didn't. And then it will go on to examine the experience of rulership that those women who were successful in their bids, kind of what their experience of rulership was versus that of the king and versus that of a queen consort, a dowager, a regent, etc. And the idea is kind of, it came out of this kind of noticing that within the medieval world, seems to be this idea that queen regnants are rare and that this is a phenomena we see more commonly in the early modern period. Think of Elizabeth I, Isabella of Castile. But actually 13 out of these 15 women were in fact recognized as the rightful rulers of the thrones that they laid claim to, though of course with varied experiences of power. And the women, the 15 women that I'm looking at are Urraca of León Castile, who is the first claim. Teresa of Portugal, who was Countess of Portugal, but self-proclaimed Queen of Portugal. And it's her son who goes on to kind of establish the Kingdom of Portugal. So I think she'll be an interesting addition. And then Melisende of Jerusalem, Empress Matilda, Lady of the English, Petronilla of Aragon, Sibylla of Jerusalem, Isabella I of Jerusalem, Constance I of Sicily, Maria of Montferrat, Queen of Jerusalem, Berengela of Castile, Isabella II of Jerusalem, Constance II of Jerusalem, my notes are incorrect, Constance II of Sicily, Juana I of Navarre, Margaret, Maid of Norway, as Queen of Scotland, and finally Juana II of Navarre.
That is such an impressive list, both of you. I can understand why you would lose track. but I'm curious about just the sheer quantity. And the reason for that is that one of the misconceptions that I often encounter when I teach, say, undergraduates is this kind of preconceived notion that, well, women didn't have power in the Middle Ages. And my response to that is always, that's not necessarily true. And that different types of power were experienced by women of different social groups, that what one woman might experience as a type of autonomy or freedom in the Third Estate might not be something that somebody in the higher ranks could experience. And that usually might have to do with things like, whether they choose to marry somebody of their, you know, of their own interest, or whether it's a political alliance, that the higher up you are, the more restrictive certain elements of your life can be, in contrast to somebody from a lower social class. But at the same time, that also, the higher up you are, the other opportunities you have. So there's this really interesting spectrum, I think. So I'm just curious about, given the breadth of both of your projects, what are the current debates then about female power and agency for your specific areas of research? And we could maybe perhaps pick the running order that we just used. Paola, if you'd like to respond first, and then Anaïs, and any place where there's really useful intersections, please note them.
Sure. Well, I think there are several current debates, and particularly something that may overlap between what Anaïs and I do is this idea of an Iberian singularity, the thought that women or queens in particular in Iberia accessed more power or maybe power differently than in other areas of medieval Europe. And that's where I feel both our researches sit, in the idea that, well, there's some room to either challenge or prove to what extent Iberia was exceptional. And without these maybe wider scope studies, it's difficult to see to what extent that claim is true or not, or to what extent it can be true. Well, in fact, there are also several differences between Iberia in 13th century, where there are up to 5 different Christian kingdoms on top of the Muslim territories and the control of the caliphate. So I think that's one of the current debates. I don't know if Anaïs wants to add something to that.
No, I completely agree with that. I think it's that's where kind of we both have a comparative methodology, and that's, I think that's where that can be really useful, is in being able to see what are the similarities and what are the differences, because there will be similarities and differences. I think another interesting aspect is we often treat Iberian queenship, we speak of Iberian queenship, but as Paola just said, there's up to 5 different kingdoms there. And what is often meant by Iberian, I think most frequently, is really Castilian. And then what the Castilian experience is then gets kind of broadened out and applied to the other kingdoms, but actually it's all quite different.
Yeah, and boundaries are never fixed either during the medieval period. So what even constitutes a region of power will shift as well. Do you think then that your work will change how these queens or these rulers are viewed in their own right? What is the impact? I know I'm asking you to put the chicken before the egg, or the egg before the chicken, right? By asking you, what's the outcome of your project? But to some degree, you must have an idea of what you anticipate or hope to find and what impact that would have on research in the broader field. So what do you think or you hope will happen in your work?
Well, in my case, having to submit the proposal. Oh, sorry. I've had to think it through a lot, and I'd say my work intends to have an impact mainly in 3 areas. One, I would say, is just simply putting into a conversation the Iberian, the Spanish nowadays, and English scholarship, and bringing the comparison to the core of my project instead of doing just maybe a comparative study between 2 case studies. I think that is already bringing forth the comparative approach. And well, secondly, actually, the study of queens' households is a rather unknown topic for 13th century Castile and Aragon. Unlike what happens in England, that, well, with studies about especially Eleanor of Castile, there is a lot of knowledge of how households worked and what their structure was like. But in Castile and in Aragon, there are plenty of studies for late medieval queens, that is for 14th and 15th century queens. So there is a huge gap in the understanding of what happened before that, what happened in the 13th century. In some cases, we don't even know if they had their own household separate from the kings or not. So that's a second aspect that I hope my thesis sheds some light to. And finally, one of the main goals, again, I'm working on it, but I'm far from it yet, is to provide an edition of the material that is available for the English queen, Eleanor of Provence, for whom exceptionally rich unedited manuscript records have survived. And well, this way, my project would make accessible to other scholars these accounts. And these accounts are, in fact, the earliest for an English queen from their household, and hopefully will enable future historians to study further aspects of this very significant historical figure.
Oh, that's fabulous. And I definitely want to come back in a few minutes to the documents, because I think there's some really fascinating material there. Anaïs, what about you?
So I actually might go back to your previous question about debates, because I think the impact of my research will probably speak more to another debate that is kind of going on, which is more broadly kind of about medieval rulership and power, and the field of queenship studies and women's history. Elite women in the Middle Ages has really just done so much to really push forward the fact that medieval women did have power, they wielded power, but we still kind of conceive of power as, you know, the king's power is different to the queen's power, and women had different types of power. And so my project is kind of speaking to that, because it's looking at these women who, you know, their power doesn't derive from their spouse, from the king, or from their son. It derives from themselves. They are the source of their own power. And yet their experience of power was not the same as their male contemporaries, but it also wasn't the same as their female contemporaries, because it's a different type of power. So it's kind of this space in between. And so that's the area that I'm kind of looking at. And so hopefully the impact of my research is kind of pushing this conversation about rulership further, and looking at the place of gender, like the relationship between gender and power, in a more nuanced way. Because as I said, you know, that these queen regnants kind of fall in this in-between space. And so in that sense, my project kind of is a study not just of queenship and women's power, but medieval power more broadly. But also I do want to say that, again, because of the comparative nature of my research, I've benefited so much from all the research that has already been done. And so the need to look at these queen regnants is something that has previously been identified, but research has tended to focus on individual queens. So I'm kind of taking advantage of all the research everyone else has done and kind of pulling it together, and hopefully being able to then... I mean, I do think that I'll be able to offer the outcome will be a more nuanced understanding of power. I do.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a perfectly valid description, right? I mean, everything we do is always built upon the backs of others, whether we agree, disagree, or expand the previous work. We get here because other people have done that work before us, right? And that they open doors for us and sometimes pose questions or even pose arguments that we either agree or disagree with, and can say or view things differently. I mean, the other aspect, of course, is that theoretically and critically, we continue to shift. So what was appropriate scholarship 50 years ago is no longer necessarily appropriate scholarship in terms of how we view things or how we view the world. So we always must revisit and reassess everything that we think in the way that we do in modern culture. When we think about language, power, gender, and identity, these things are not fixed to the Middle Ages, right? They are ongoing in our own period as well. So how did you, before we go to the documents part, how did you both end up in this realm, so to speak, to use a queenly metaphor. But in the sense of, I know that, as I mentioned earlier, you both studied at King's, but was it that experience that led you on this path, or what was your hook, so to speak? What was the thing that led you to this topic or to this area of research in your quote unquote academic journey or your life as a student? Was there a moment where you had an aha, that's what I'm going to do? Or was it a slow unfolding process?
Well, in my case, I became really interested in women's history during my last year of my undergraduate studies here in Madrid. And I did my dissertation on the historiographical concept of queenship back then, because I wanted to see how it had influenced the Spanish scholarship, since it was not a historiographical concept that had been born here. And then when I went to study my master's at KCL at King's, I think that was more my aha moment, as you said, because that's where I met Professor David Carpenter, who introduced me to the queen, English queen, Eleanor of Provence. And I became fascinated with 13th century England, something that had never caught my attention before going to King's. And as the time to choose a topic for the thesis approach, I thought, wouldn't it be amazing if I could just bring together the Iberian and the English queenship in a project? So slowly, and thanks, I must say, thanks to both Professor David Carpenter and Professor Louise Wilkinson, who really helped me shape my rather scattered thoughts into a project. During lockdown, I applied to Lincoln. And well, in terms of why households and why focus on that, I wanted, as Anaïs does, to understand how women access power. And I thought, well, that necessarily has to be linked to their resources or their networks and their supporters. So that's how I became interested in their households, and especially in the queen consort, because maybe, I don't think it's a forgotten figure, but it has a lot of room yet to be explored.
Yeah, we just really do. Even with the changes in the past 50 years, I mean, we still really prioritize male figures, right? I mean, that's a truth about our discipline, regardless of what, you know, whether we like it or not, but it is starting to shift, thankfully, precisely because of these kinds of projects. Anaïs, what about you?
So, similarly to Paola, I'd say my journey started as an undergraduate. I just remember taking this one course, and we were, for one of the seminars, we were talking about the Hundred Years' War and kind of Anglo-French relationships during the Anglo-French Wars and before and after. And I just became really interested in this dynamic between the two kingdoms. And then when I was at King's doing my MA, I kind of wanted to explore this further, but thought maybe there could be kind of another angle to look at it. So that's when I started thinking about marriage alliances and such, and kind of came across Eleanor and Marguerite of Provence, who were the focus of my MA dissertation. And they are, so Eleanor was married to Henry III of England, and Marguerite was married to Louis IX of France. And that marriage and the family relationship it created really did have an impact on Anglo-French relations in the 13th century. And so that's kind of that was my aha moment after already being interested in this. So the sisters were the focus of my MA dissertation. And then for my thesis, I kind of continued with this focus on the 13th century and relationships and such, but I expanded it out to have five women in total. So I added Berengela of Castile, Blanche of Castile, who were themselves sisters as well in Castile and France, and then Violante of Hungary. And this is actually to address another aspect of the debate that we didn't touch on earlier, which is kind of this divide between Northern queenship and Southern queenship, which is related to the Iberian exceptionalism idea. So that was that. And then my postdoctoral project is, I suppose, just building up on that and kind of looking more specifically at the gender dynamics of power, because as all my previous research, my dissertation, my MA dissertation, my doctoral thesis, like, women obviously had power. It was different to men's. And so just kind of wanting to understand that better. So I suppose, yeah, just kind of a long unfolding journey in that sense.
It is. And, you know, I mean, I had a similar moment. My project and my research is very different from what you do, but I remember as a master's student, you know, I had to submit my proposal really early in the year, and I put in a proposal, and then I took a module in my second semester that changed everything. And if I had had that module first year, my master's thesis would have been something completely different. But that module then changed my entire career trajectory, right? That you just don't know. And I always say this to my students, take something you don't know. Right? Don't necessarily just limit yourself to the things that you already know and feel comfortable with, because you don't know what doors will open when you step through. And you don't know what else will happen when you step through an open door anyway, right? If you take a module that is like that looks interesting, I know nothing about it, let's go and see, it could shift everything. And that's, I mean, to me, that's the beauty of what we do as researchers, right? That we open a book and we don't know what we're going to find. And then you can go down a rabbit hole, but that rabbit hole could actually end up being a whole new project. So those are the reasons we do what we do. So going back to the actual hard materials that you're working with, I'm really curious to know, I have several questions about all of this. And the first one is really just those documents. So I know that you're talking about household accounts and other records, but what are the quantities or the qualities of these types of documents? Where are they kept? How do you have access to them? What is the main resource that you each work with? And then what are the challenges of working with them as a medievalist, but also presumably as an archivist of some sort?
Well, in my case, as I said, I'm working with three kingdoms, right? So that's like a starting point. And for all of them, I mostly work with written records, whether these be chronicles, legal treaties, chancery records. But as you said, Renee, I mostly work with household accounts, or in general, I'd say chancery records of all sorts. In the Iberian case, for Castile and Aragon, the documents I tend to work with were produced either by the king's chancery or by, let's say, religious institutions that were linked to the queens, because there are not many documents surviving from the queen's own chancery or from the queen's own household. So this means that I usually work with, let's say, dowers or dowry contracts, marriage agreements, queen's testaments. These are just some of these examples. And nowadays, they've usually been edited together with the material surviving from their husbands. So they are accessible through several libraries, such as the Biblioteca Nacional here in Madrid, which is where I'm right now working. But these are throughout all the libraries in Europe. They tend to be some editions of this material. In contrast, for the English part of my thesis, there are a lot of edited sources, but there is an extraordinary amount of unedited household records, particularly for the reign of Eleanor of Provence, who, as Anais has mentioned, she was Henry III's consort. And well, there are more or less around 20 extant household records and wardrobe accounts. So these are kept in the National Archives in Kew, but several of them, if not all, can be accessed online. And in terms of how I work with them or how I face these challenges, the Iberian material, as I work with edited sources, these are usually either in Latin, in Catalan, or in Spanish. And in the English case, the challenge is that much of the documentation is unedited. So first I have to work through the paleography, transcribe the document, and then begin translating them from Latin to English. I must add, slower than one would want it to be. And once I have that figured out, I try to just organize my primary sources thematically. As you said, there is a lot of abundance of sources, and then see what type of information these provide. Do they mention the queen's personnel? Are they useful to track the queen's lands? Do they instead mention the queen's cash resources? So I try to organize that and then analyze this information to contrast the data between different queens and different kingdoms.
That just sounds like so much work. I mean, and I've done, I've worked with archives, so I get it, but it's exhausting listening to you go through the list. Anais?
I have a bit of a two-part answer, if that's all right, because I know the focus is mainly my current postdoc, but it is a different experience from my own doctoral research. And so for my thesis, I was just looking at letters, essentially, primarily royal letters. So those kind of more ephemeral letters sent between, exchanged by relatives or contemporary monarchs and such, but also the more solemn royal documents produced by chanceries. So that was a bit more focused and contained in that sense. And that survival of letters is kind of a bit disparate. Paola has mentioned before that Eleanor has a vast kind of source base in existence, and she has a total of about 222 letters that have survived and are, for the most part, preserved at the National Archives. In comparison, Marguerite only has like 43, and the Iberian Blanche of Castile only has 4. Though I think there's a whole other reason for that. Berengela has about 18 and Violante has 9. So there's kind of huge differences there. And actually a really great resource is Epistolae for women's letters, because it's this this online database that just has letter of women from the 500 to 1500 roughly, and they're in their original language, but then there's a translation as well, and it will give you kind of edited sources, manuscript sources, and it's great in that sense. And for my postdoc, I'm for the Leverhulme, I'm still kind of trying to figure that out exactly. But as Paolo is kind of what Paolo was saying before, that it's just there's a lot of resources, but there is the benefit that a lot has been edited and such. And so I'm going to hopefully be using documentary, narrative, and material sources in that sense. That also just made me think of the fact that sometimes if you have a project revolving around a specific source, like my doctoral thesis, which was letters, it's a bit easier when you kind of come up with this idea of like, I'm going to compare all these women. Then you have to go out and actually find resources for them. A little harder, I'm finding.
But I mean, that's how the groundbreaking work happens, right? Is that we dig those holes and then have to excavate ourselves from them. I think it's one of the things that Paola said is really telling, is that some of the really useful material is the reading in between the lines of what's already out there for the male members of the household, right? That there is evidence, it just hasn't necessarily been paid attention to. It's just being able to identify it. And then also the database of the letters sounded really fabulous, that somebody took the time to do that. That's wonderful. And that's the real benefit of working in a digital age, is that the more we can provide access to materials in some kind of virtual format, the more people have access to them, the more work can be done, and the more these stories can be recovered.
An interpretation performed by Roberto Penas of the Cantiga number 11 by Alfonso X. So Alfonso X is actually a 13th century Castilian king who is married to one of the queens in my study, Violante of Aragon, who I'm sure Anais has also encountered through her research. And the many interests and initiatives that Alfonso X had have made him known as Alfonso the Wise. One of those interests was the creation of these cantigas, which are poems with musical notation written in Galician. And although not all of the cantigas were created by him directly, these were definitely composed within his court, and he was closely involved in the production of at least some of them. And well, these are one of the largest collection of monophonic or solo songs from the Middle Ages, with their main focus being the Virgin Mary. So we thought it was appropriate for today's topic of discussion.
Absolutely. And it's one of the things I like about this podcast is being able to just introduce people to some of the fabulous music, whether it's originally medieval or adaptations of medieval as well. But getting back to the questions to do with your work, and particularly, I'd like to shift gears slightly and think about the context of your work, not from the academic perspective. Well, it is somewhat academic, but from the perspective of how we actually work, particularly right now, given that the past year has been perhaps one of the most difficult years we have all faced in our lives ever. And I say that as somebody that is on the cusp of half a century. And so over the past year, because so much of what you do is archival and deals with kind of getting access to things, how have you managed the restrictions? How have your working patterns changed? And really, from the perspective of an archivist, I know that there are a lot of things that you've said have been edited, which I'm sure has made life easier. But what have been the biggest challenges for you as a researcher in the COVID era, as we might call it these days?
Well, in my case particularly, it actually, I don't know if it has really impacted it in the terms of research, but in terms of my life plan, it definitely has, because my idea was, well, in September 2020, I'm moving from London to Lincoln. I'm going to start working on my English Queens. And well, when all this happened, I came back to Spain. So that's where I've been and I am right now. And that made me reshape the order in which I was going to look into everything. So what I did instead was start with the Iberian material, with the Aragonese and English Queens, and thought, well, I'm going to make the most of this year while I'm home. And the truth is, I've been able to access some libraries right now because our restrictions have been different from the ones in the UK for the past 6 months. Although it has made me say, well, I'm just going to work with the edited material for this part of my thesis. I'm going to quote unquote give up on the archival sources at the moment. I'm not going to go and try to find something new that maybe now that I'm looking closely to these queens or these household records, I may find something. Well, I've had to give that up. But I feel privileged in a sense because I have had access to edited material, to edited sources that has enabled me to keep going through this year that has radically changed the plans I had initially. And hopefully at the end of 2021, I'll be back in England, in Lincoln, working now on my English material. So that's that for me.
Yeah, it has been a roller coaster ride for sure for everybody. Anais, because I know you are not in Lincoln either, right?
We are. I am not. I am not either. Yeah, it's been a bit of a mixed bag for me because the whole COVID lockdown and all that happened about a month and a bit after, about 6 weeks after I had had my viva, and had submitted my corrections, and after I had submitted my Leverhulme application. So I didn't actually have too much kind of coming up immediately. And then COVID happened and I ended up in Norway, not the UK. And I think the biggest impact for me personally has been productivity and the ability to focus. I'm the type of person who just thrives on routine and a clear home work divide. And that's just been impossible. So that, for me, that has actually been the bigger issue personally than my inability to access the archives. Cause kind of, as we've said before, and as Paola was saying, there is enough edited material and material online to kind of see me through this initial bit. So I am still able to do research. And kind of, as I said before, the comparative nature of my work means that I'm also doing a lot of looking at secondary literature at the moment to kind of find my footing in this topic that is broader geographically and temporally than my previous research. So it's been more about kind of finding, being able to focus and have the environment that allows me to be the most productive I can be. I am also very grateful to the Leverhulme budget, research budget I get, which has also allowed me to buy some books that have been really hard to access online. So I've just impossible to access. So I'm also eternally grateful for that, because that's also seen me through some more research as well.
Yeah, no, I hear you on that front. I mean, I've been fortunate with the library and the interlibrary loans team, but there have been a couple of things I've had to purchase for exactly the same reason. And I think your response also really speaks to something that is true of this kind of work. The routine, I'm a creature of routine, that for me, having a very clear pattern, a daily routine really helps. But also, the other part is that much of what we do, particularly once you get past the undergraduate level, can be so isolating. Yeah. And I think I've seen undergraduate students really struggling this year. And I've been impressed by some of the things I've seen, you know, my own institution doing and the well-being doing. And it is good for some students, but for other students, it's not enough. Or seeing students at the MA level or the PhD level in a discipline that, or a field that is inherently already isolating. We spend so much time by ourselves, even when we are introverted individuals, we take for granted that communication we have from on-campus sessions or research talks, professional sessions that you might do as a student, that all of these things give you a social community and make you feel like you're speaking to other human beings, right? So there's this sense of you're getting your social, you're being able to scratch that social itch if you can. And to be in a room with other people in person is a very different feeling from being on a Zoom call with a bunch of other people, especially when that Zoom call is in your spare bedroom or at your kitchen table. And so it's really, I think, actually useful for you to talk about that, because I think mental health is a big issue. It's been a huge issue in the past year, but it's also a really big issue in the discipline, right? That we do spend a lot of time by ourselves. And it really stresses, this past year has really stressed for me how important community is. And it doesn't have to be an academic community, but anybody undertaking academic work needs a strong support system, whether it's inside or outside of the academy, right? That is what will get us through and keep us sane at kind of in the worst of times as we are experiencing. So on a similar note then, are there pieces of advice? I'm jumping around a bit. There's a couple of other questions I want to come back to that are more practical, but given that we're talking about mental health and the journey of the student and then the early researcher, early career researcher, Anna East, is there advice that you would give Paola as somebody at the other end of the spectrum, having, you know, recently completed and submitted and now moving on? If you could go back and tell yourself something, you know, Anaïs in year one of PhD, what advice would you offer that would be useful for Paola?
Because Paola and I know each other from King's, we've actually discussed this on a few occasions. There's several things I would say. Now I'm just trying to think which one to start with, but I, specifically relating to the thesis, my number one advice is always, you know, don't leave your footnotes incomplete. And actually listen to that, because someone told me that when I was in the first year of my thesis, and I was like,
"You'll do it."
I know, exactly. And I was like, why would you leave your footnotes incomplete? That makes no sense. And the last month of my dissertation, of my thesis, I was just kind of frantically like going through footnotes that literally say, it's in one of your Word docs on so-and-so, like somewhere. You know, find it and just kind of having to recall, or like, you know, I read this in a book by whoever, and then just kind of trying to frantically find that footnote. So don't leave it incomplete and actually heed other people's advice, because I did not. I just was kind of like, it'll be fine. And it's just such a source of anxiety for no reason.
When you reference somebody,
I still do that as well.
And you reference somebody, only you've got 5 books by that person, and you're like, it's Walker Bynum on Metamorphosis. And you're like, she talks about that in all of her books.
And she has so many books.
And you think to yourself as you're doing it, I'll remember this. It's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I actually have this weird thing where I have a bit of a visual memory. So like if I have a recollection of writing something down, I can almost picture myself having read it somewhere. And then I'm kind of like, but what was it? Like I can picture it on the page, but I'm like, but the page of which book? What book is this? I feel like that is an important point. Mm-hmm. But more specifically, kind of going back to what we were saying before about like mental health and all that. I don't know if I necessarily needed to know these in my first year, but I definitely discovered them because I took the full 4 years to do my thesis. I think finding a support group of people you can chat with is just so important. And I know that we have the Medieval Studies Research Group kind of PhD cohort that kind of provides that, which is amazing. And I for me, that took various shapes, but back at King's, we had a reading group, which was very interdisciplinary. It was kind of all the medievalists of the various departments, and we would read each other's work, and that was amazing. But I also actually had a library buddy who was a year behind me in the PhD, and we just would always sit next to each other, and we'd have our own music on. But then every once in a while, he works on kind of early modern Portuguese nuns. So also quite a lot of royalty there. So we would sometimes just interrupt each other and be like, am I getting this translation correct? Or like, oh, I'm trying to say this one word, what is it? And, or just kind of like, oh my God, I just found this amazing letter. Can I tell you about it? And it was just, it was great to have this person that you could take a brief break with, ask a question, help. If you know how sometimes you have this idea in your head and it's not quite what you want it to be. And so just talking about it to somebody else. We'd always take a lunch break together. So kind of leave our desk, go do something. I found that really helpful. And then when I was finishing my thesis, he actually went through my entire bibliography to make sure that it was in alphabetical order and actually like consistent citation format. And I will forever be grateful to him for that. So find someone who can do that, because he did it in 2 hours. He put some music on and he just got it done. I probably would have screamed if I had to look at it for any longer. Mm-hmm. He's submitting his thesis in a few months, and I will be doing the same for him. So kind of having this kind of solid group, I think is so important. And then, as I said also before, routine, find what works for you. And don't forget to switch off. Genuinely switch off, because especially when, this applies even later in your career as well, but as a PhD student, you're kind of like, oh, I need to do this, I need to do that. And like, cause you're always off, you're also always on. Mm-hmm. I think being from abroad is helpful, because when you go home to visit family, you're like definitely done.
I hear you. Yeah. And your point, even just about getting up and going, taking lunch, right? Like walking away from your desk for 30 minutes is necessary.
Yeah. I think much harder when you work from home.
Yeah, no, again, right? Absolutely. The space we occupy can be challenging. And I would agree with all of those things there. The writing group, the sharing work. I tell my undergraduates, this is a really good practice to get into, especially if you want to go into grad studies. I think it's a really fruitful one. Paola, is there anything that you would like to ask Anaïs that you guys haven't talked about or that you think would be useful to know?
Well, again, as Anaïs said herself, we've had this friendship going for like over a year now. So there's been time to share these tips. And I'd actually like to say it's been great, and I feel very grateful to have had the chance to have someone else share these in a more informal way. And she's always been there to, well, to be bothered by me with minor and major questions about my project. And I guess I'd say, maybe just for whoever is listening, if you and is starting to do their PhD as I am, and on top of everything you've already said, which was all great, great tips and great advice, if you could, like, if there was a single thing you wish you had known when you started, or like a single, like a really important thing you wish you had known, what would that be, in your opinion?
I'm not, I guess, actually, I think one important thing would be that it might seem like you don't have that much time, because like you have like that on one hand you have a lot of time, but on the other hand you don't, and you have all this stuff you want to do, and that it's okay to actually still be figuring out what you want to do in your first year. I think that, you know, you come into it with you've got a proposal, you have this idea of what you're going to do, and as everyone knows, the thesis that you end up handing in is not the thesis that you conceive of. And so I guess kind of accepting that, allowing that to happen, and also not being too hard on yourself for not, you know, being as focused or productive or whatever in your first year. So much of your first year is really finding your footing. And I mean, I say this as someone who took the full 4 years to finish her PhD. And I know people can do that in less time, which is amazing for them. But I remember starting kind of being like, right, I need to get this done. And you have this very specific idea of how everything should unfold. And so just knowing that it's actually okay if it doesn't all go to plan.
Be kind to yourself, right? And be kind to your future self. Mm-hmm. I think, and it's interesting because that is advice that I repeat to my undergraduate students as well. I mean, it doesn't matter what level you're doing research at, but those general premises, especially the you think you're going to write one thing, but it'll be something else, is so true no matter what level your project is.
And it's actually, if I can just interrupt quickly, like that's actually exciting as well. Like I remember being so excited about my proposed project, but actually what ended up coming out was even better and built on that original project. So not resisting that, just kind of being like, no, okay, well, this is what I'm thinking, but it will take me somewhere else and we'll see what that is.
Let's all hope that is also true for mine. So.
that is what research is, right? That is precisely what research is. If you end up with a project that is exactly what you think it is going to be, you've probably missed something.
Yeah.
Right? That's just a good rule to think about. I wanted to kind of finish off with two final questions. One of them is very practical, and this can tie in with what you've done in the past year, how you've adapted your studies. But of course, not everybody that completes a PhD will end up getting an academic job, right? The simple truth is that there are far more people studying than there are jobs currently available. And that has been true, I think, for years. I mean, for at least decades, and will continue to be true, particularly with government finance pressures and cuts and things like that. So from your perspective, what are the most valuable transferable skills that you have gained through your graduate work that if the desired kind of outcome of I'd like the academic job doesn't come to fruition, how do you see yourself not reinventing yourself, but what skills do you see as, you know what, I will be able to use that and do this? Those things that we consider or we call those highly transferable skills, right? To use the marketing term, what are the best things that you can think of for yourself as those transferable skills? What will you gain in a non-academic world from your academic work? Ooh, Anaïs, I think Paola's frozen, so if you'd like to go.
I will, yeah. So I guess I actually took a bit of time off between my undergrad and my MA, and then I did my MA part-time, and then I took time off between my MA and my PhD. So I think a lot of what I've learned, a lot of the transferable skills I've acquired, I probably appreciate them more because I've gone through that experience as well. And I'd say that, obviously history has a lot of transferable skills that we are all aware of, but I would say that the thesis itself has really helped me improve how I approach time and project management. And as I was saying before, you conceive of your project in a certain way and it must go a certain way. And so kind of allowing for changes, allowing for blanking on the exact word that I'm looking for here, but learning how to kind of manage your time effectively and again, because sometimes you're always on and off at the same time, like actually forcing yourself to stay on at a certain time so that you can then have time off, and pacing yourself so as to not burn out. I also did some GTAing during the thesis, and I think that has a lot of transferable skills as well beyond preparing you to teach if you decide to go into academia, and that's just that it teaches you to be a better communicator. I think it's so easy to get caught in your kind of research tunnel vision and interacting with people, your supervisors or whoever, who have a knowledge of what you're talking about, that then going back to teaching first year undergraduates who often, at least in my case, weren't particularly interested in medieval history. You have to adapt how you're communicating and conveying a lot of this information, and communicating with, you know, people who are in a different age group and all that. So I think teaching is extremely helpful in that sense as well, and kind of, yeah, improving those skills.
Yeah, and I know for me, I seem very extroverted in a lot of ways, but do have very introverted tendencies. And one of the things that really helps with teaching, of course, is that it forced me, I've been doing it for 20 years now, but over time it has forced me to become more and more comfortable with public speaking, right? So the premise of being in a room full of people and being the person that everybody is listening to, which is also reinforced by conference papers, this sense that that's part of what we do as an academic, whether you're a student or somebody that's in a position of some sort, there is this element that increases your confidence, and doing those things, even if you loathe them, which, you know, to some extent, I still have moments where I think, oh, you know, a new group of students makes me nervous, or going to a conference, even after 20 years, walking into a room makes me nervous. So those skills, I think, are also extremely productive and useful. And I would agree with everything that you've said. It does look like Paola has disconnected, and we'll hopefully get her to reconnect shortly. I have one more question then that I will ask you, Anaïs, and then we'll see how we are doing. And the last one is really just about Lincoln, because you did your master's and your PhD at the same institution. So why did you come here, or why did you select Lincoln as the place to take up your fellowship?
Yeah, so because my project addresses kind of various of the topics that we've addressed, but essentially this, I mean, it doesn't explicitly address the Iberian exceptionalism and North-South divide, but that is a strong element of my research.
I know we've been on this, we're doing this for a while, and your brain just starts to get tired as the hour goes down, right?
Yeah. No, but I mean, I suppose what first drew me to Lincoln was really Antonella, who is my mentor for this project. And she is just such an amazing fit for my project. Our research kind of intersects but doesn't overlap fully. So I really appreciate, obviously you want your supervisor, your mentor to have knowledge of your field, but I really think that not having the exact same specialty can really help bringing in an outside perspective in that sense. And so Antonella just, I just remember kind of looking up potential people to approach, and she had given a paper at the London Society for Medieval Studies, which I was a committee member of at the time at the IHR. And her research just seemed so interesting to me. So I kind of looked her up and then approached her, and then, you know, just kind of realized how much more Lincoln also has to offer besides Antonella. And then also that Louise was moving there, and she does specialize in kind of medieval elite women and rulership in that sense as well. And so it was just kind of the perfect balance in that sense. And the medieval studies research group, which, as I've said before, it's interdisciplinary, and I find that so important for research. And the Iberianist cluster that Lincoln also has. So it was just kind of ticked all the boxes.
I hear you. I mean, it's certainly, I'm not an Iberianist, but a lot of the things you've mentioned, there are definitely reasons why when I had the opportunity to come and work at Lincoln, those were, again, some of the same reasons. Paola, we're just finishing up here. So the last two questions that I had asked Anaïs, I will pose to you. And I'm glad you were able to rejoin us. So the first one was, what do you see as the most transferable skills that if you have to pursue a career outside of academia, what do you think you will benefit the most from skills-wise in terms of your studies? And then the final question is, why was Lincoln the right place for you to come and do your PhD?
First, thank you for the patience with my internet issues. So I hope I don't go back and say what Anaïs has already mentioned, but in terms of what transferable skills you may be able to adapt beyond an institutional career, I'd say, first of all, in my case, I'm learning a lot of languages, because you are forced to, especially if you're coming from a non-English speaking country, like I do, you see that in order to be able to study wherever you want to, you tend to need to learn, in my case, English or French or Latin, and that's a skill that will be helpful beyond academia for sure. And to that, I may also add the ability to analyze and critical thinking are very, very important skills I have to apply almost every day when I'm working on my thesis. And that I may also add, I'd say, resourcefulness, because you, especially now in times of COVID, you have to find a way to go around things and get yourself some book that you're not able to find. So you try to talk to someone, and that's something that's going to be able, you're going to be able to apply beyond your thesis, beyond your project, or beyond your dissertation, whatever level you're studying in. And last but not least, I say the ability to speak in public. Just for me to be able to do this today, when 2 years ago I was taking like 8 hours a week of English classes, and now I feel confident enough to do this. And these are things that I've actually myself experienced when I've been working as a extracurricular activities teacher or as a leisure time instructor, which I've also been working as. I feel like these skills have helped me immensely to develop my job better than if I had never worked in academia. And going on to the question about why Lincoln, well, I genuinely believe Lincoln is the best place where I could develop my research, and it's mainly because first and foremost, the supervisors, the great supervisors I have. Professor Louise Wilkinson is a leading authority on royal women and medieval records, and Dr. Antonella Liutzos-Corpo is an expert on Iberian history and the Mediterranean. So I feel that they both give me excellent feedback, advice, and guidance on my project that sometimes is something difficult to find. I could have come back here and enrolled on a PhD program in Spain, or I could have stayed in London maybe, or applied there. But I really felt that this is where my research would benefit most. And to that, I must add the department that hosts the Medieval Studies Research Group. I haven't been able to hear Anais's response, but I'm sure she's mentioned it's an extremely supportive community. We help like every couple of weeks. We see each other. We do a reading group. We comment on how we're all doing, and it makes me feel very accompanied and supported through the process, which I think it's, as we were mentioning earlier when talking about mental health, I think it's crucial if you're embarking yourself in a 3-year project as a thesis or a postdoc or a career.
No, absolutely. And yeah, Anais did talk about those things, but I think they bear repeating. So thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you both for sharing your research and your experiences with us today. And as I mentioned at the very outset of this podcast, we hope to feature the rest of our grad students over the course of the next year. But that means I may also come back to you in 18 months to check in and see how you're doing and see how Absolutely. The work has progressed. And thank you, of course, to Alex, our wonderful host, who, as always, brings his skills and expertise to the forefront to support us. And we greatly appreciate that. So thank you again. Thank you to anybody who's listening. I hope this has been useful, not only to get a glimpse into the work that's being done at Lincoln by two of our scholars on medieval queens and medieval women, but also on what it means to be a grad student or an early career researcher, especially right now in these unparalleled times, at least for us in the 21st century. And thank you both for your time today and sharing all of your work and ideas with us.
Thank you very much for having us. We're going to be looking forward to coming back in some months then. Yeah.